It's June. I've been stuck inside for months, all the restaurants are opening up, and I'm literally dying of boredom. Can I go hang out with my friends yet? The answer is no. I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. Quote, "The stranger rode beside her, easily, lightly, his reins loose in his half-closed hand, straight and elegant in dark shabby garments that flapped upon his bones. His pale face smiled in an evil trance. He did not glance at her. Ah, I have seen this fellow before. I know this man if I could place him. He is no stranger to me." This is the premonition that the protagonist of Catherine Ann Porter's Pale Horse, Pale Rider wakes with on the morning of her influenza infection in 1918. The short novel depicts a young newspaper woman in Denver, Colorado, who emerges from her illness shaken to the core and profoundly changed. She emerges into a very different world than the one she left. Quote, "No more war, no more plague, only the day's silence that follows the ceasing of the heavy guns. Noiseless houses with the shades drawn, empty streets, the dead cold light of tomorrow." Porter herself worked for the Rocky Mountain News here in Denver and fell gravely ill during the 1918 pandemic. She wrote Pale Horse, Pale Rider in 1939, just as the world was descending into yet another war. 2 decades after the devastation, she was still processing the experience. She was not alone in carrying the psychological and physiological scars for the rest of her life. I want to throw in a quick note. You may in this episode hear more background noise than normal. That's because I live near the Capitol here in Denver, and the police have been flying helicopters around it for the past 3 days straight. So, unfortunately, nothing I can do about that. Over the last few months, many of us have seen a pretty significant change in our lives. We're living and dying in historic times. The only other event of this magnitude in my lifetime was 9/11. Approximately 3,000 people died in the attacks on September 11th, 2001. As of May 15th, an average of 2,000 Americans have died every day for the last 30 days. The two events are incomparable. They are completely different in nature. My point with the numbers is to help us get a sense of the scale of how many Americans are affected by this pandemic. Since early April, every 2 days, Americans lose more countrymen than we did on 9/11. The daily death rate continues to grow, and it's impossible to say how many people are currently infected, or will be before this is over. We appear to have just peaked, and it's hard to say whether there will be another phase of infection and what that will look like. What is clear is that this experience will leave a lasting impact on our society and our psyche. We are witnessing nothing close to the severity of the plague that Catherine Ann Porter did in 1918. But we also don't see the deaths that were commonplace in Porter's day, and a huge range of illnesses have been cured or mitigated. Death from illness like this is not normal in 2020, and that's why this is so shocking. Today I want to look into the cultural objects that will stick with us: the quarantines, the masks, the economic closures, and something we hopefully see but may not, the vaccine. Why did COVID hit us so hard, and why did we respond in the way that we did? The answer lies in our history, the successes and failures we carry as a society. Let's try to understand these pandemic times better by looking at the history of medical science, our system of public health, and the event so traumatic that it shaped modern medicine, the influenza pandemic of 1918. Humans have been using quarantine to combat disease since ancient times, long before the development of germ theory. It features in many ancient religions as part of the idea of ritual purity. Persons who violated social taboos were set apart from the community as unclean, and often physical illness was treated as a form of moral degeneracy, and it could be spread through contact. An example of this comes from Leviticus, written around the 7th century BCE, where a 7 to 14 day isolation is required for people exhibiting ringworm symptoms. I have read that the prescriptions against shellfish and pork in Leviticus were public health guidelines, since those animals needed to be more properly cooked to be safe to eat. In ancient times, things that we consider to be different parts of public life, like government administration, religion, and law, were tightly entwined. That's why Leviticus, which is essentially a legal and moral code for an ancient Jewish society, is still considered a holy book to virtually all Christians, Muslims, and Jews. It presents health advice, laws, and moral codes under the same framing of clean versus unclean. It places our ringworm patient in the company of lepers, menstruating women, cross-dressers, and homosexuals. This association between illness, taboo, and social deviance wasn't excised from medical practice until the 20th century, and it still lives on amongst faith healers and televangelists in America today. We get the term quarantine from the Venetian term for 40 days. That was the period of time that ships needed to wait to be able to dock at Venice, at the height of the Black Death. In the 14th century, several cities found that stopping the flow of people could slow the spread of plague. The city of Ragusa on the Dalmatian coast had success requiring visitors to stay isolated on a nearby island or on their ship for 30 days before entering the city. The Venetians, further up the Adriatic Sea on the Italian side, instituted the same policy, but with a length of 40 days. This apparently worked as well as it did, because the progress of the bubonic plague took 37 days from infection to death. Quarantines were established because they worked. Prevailing medical theory ascribed the plague to bad air, called miasma, usually triggered by the machinations of the stars. Astrology formed the basis of many medieval theories about fortune, both on a personal level and for civilization as a whole, and health was considered a component of personal and societal fortune. It's no coincidence that the first cities to adopt quarantine were the port cities of the Mediterranean. The Black Death passed from Asia along the newly opened Mongol trading routes into the ports of the Turkish and Byzantine empires, and then passed from those ports onto the south coast of Europe, into the mainland through traders and travelers. It's no coincidence that the first quarantine islands used by these port cities were converted leper colonies. The isolation of plague victims was inspired by the ritual purity idea that kept lepers isolated. We now know that quarantines work because communicable disease, disease that can be transferred, is primarily caused by microscopic organisms. Quarantine is especially effective against diseases like leprosy and bubonic plague because they're not particularly contagious. Yes, I am saying that the plague that killed a third to a half of all Europeans wasn't particularly contagious. I'll come back to that. But first, let's talk about leprosy. 95% of people exposed to the leprosy bacteria do not contract the disease. It requires prolonged close contact with an infected person to have a chance of becoming infected. And even then, some people are genetically immune. Therefore, it's the perfect disease for society to learn the idea of quarantine from. Even minimal quarantining can help reduce the spread. It makes sense that there should be a religious taboo around lepers because there's a reciprocal relationship between reality and human culture. In a time when religion and philosophy are one and the same, the fact that isolation of a disease saves lives enters law as a religious prescription. The idea of isolation becomes amplified in the culture by reciprocations between its effectiveness as a health policy and its use in marginalizing social deviance. The ill and the odd become stigmatized classes. The ritual purity idea continues to this day in our treatment of social deviance. Cultures around the world since ancient times have put social deviance classed as criminals in prison for reasons ranging from isolation to punishment to reform. The United States of today has embraced this idea wholeheartedly and currently imprisons more people than any country ever in history. Three times as many as we imprisoned in 1980. We also take this a step further with the idea that felons legally must disclose their criminal past to prospective employers, which keeps them from ever fully reintegrating into society. This is a form of ritual cleanliness that increases recidivism by keeping felons on the margins of society. But it may also be true that felons have a natural recidivism rate, that a felon will commit another felony for similar reasons as he did the first one. It may be that there is a reciprocating effect between reducing the social impact of crime and stigmatizing felons as undesirable members of society. It's hard to say. This is taken to yet a further extreme with sex offender registries. Sex offenders must disclose their status to their neighbors, join the local state registry, which can prevent employment in many cases, and stay a certain distance from places like schools, playgrounds, and churches where children might congregate. This can make the majority of space in a city off-limits to sex offenders, and can lead to the creation of sex offender colonies, where sex offenders, mostly homeless, become a hotbed for crime, drugs, prostitution, and, of course, disease. It's possible that this makes cities safer. It's also possible that this makes cities more dangerous. It's certain that this keeps convicted criminals ritually isolated. Jails are hotbeds for disease. Disease spreads most effectively in cramped, unsanitary conditions. Today, the coronavirus is ravaging prison populations due to crowding in relatively sanitary conditions. Historically, jails were extremely unsanitary, often small, dark, and crowded. Jails had no plumbing or regular cleaning. Jails served as repositories for disease and as vectors for reintroducing that disease into the population. Typhus became called jail fever, and typhus epidemics were commonly understood to follow wars and famines, any time when people were forced into close, unsanitary conditions. We can see the process of disease transmission very clearly by looking at the medieval English courts. During and after the Norman invasion, a compromise formed between the rural Anglo-Saxon aristocracy and their new Norman king. The king had sole authority to decide most legal suits, and in return, the king needed to take his court on regular circuits throughout the country to dispense justice. Eventually, this was turned into a system of devolved powers, but in the medieval and early modern periods, direct representatives of the king would travel along these circuits, dispensing rulings castle by castle. This provides a perfect example of disease reservoirs and vectors. Accused criminals would be kept in the local jail until the next visit by the circuit judge. All judges and most plaintiffs were of the noble class, while most of the accused were not. After stewing in jail diseases for a few months, prisoners would be brought to court where they shared space with nobles and city folk. Sometimes the disease would spread into the general population. Sometimes the nobles themselves would catch it. Frequently, the judges would then pollinate these diseases from town to town as they continued their route. We hear from 1577 of the Black Aziz of Oxford, in which over 300 people died of jail fever during and after one of these court sessions. You'd be right to wonder why it's notable for 300 people to die of typhus in medieval England. It seems common. The answer would be that the Black Azizes of the 16th century killed magistrates who were members of the aristocracy. Disease is classist. Microorganisms attack people indiscriminately, but they don't always have the opportunity to do so. Slums make great disease reservoirs for the same reason that jails do. They're crowded and unsanitary. Disease has more opportunities to attack their targets, and the targets are less effective at fighting the disease off. We can see this in the Black Death. Samuel Pepys, an aristocrat diarist and civil servant, saw plenty of death as the plague flared up in London in 1665. But it affected him little personally. While his servants died, Pepys worked, socialized, and partied like never before. The immune system is affected by many things, like nutrition, exercise, mental health, and air quality, things that the working class can't afford. For this reason, most cities, through most of history, have experienced more deaths than births each year. The majority of city growth has always been the result of immigration. This changed suddenly in the 20th century due to the advances in medicine and nutrition, and the world population exploded from around 1 billion in 1800 to 7 billion in 2011. That means that it took about 200,000 years of human history for the world's population to reach 1 billion, and then in 200 years, it reached 6 billion more. When disease moves through a population, it is always the people on the margins who are the hardest hit. I mean the people who are poor, elderly, homeless, unemployed, or discriminated against. These are the groups that benefit the most from improvements in public health. One of the first major public health interventions came in 1854. As in the 14th century, the leading explanation for plague was still miasma, bad air. The miasma theory of disease had now moved on from astrology as its ultimate cause to the unsanitary conditions of the poor. For the people of the 19th century, this still had a moral implication. The poor were assumed to live in squalor because of a lack of personal responsibility for their homes and neighborhoods. Victorians railed against the sin of idleness, the idea that the squalid conditions of the poor were caused by a lack of initiative on their part. The services needed to improve the cleanliness, of course, were not available. No proper sewers had been dug. The only garbage collection was done by dustmen, who collected things that could bring them a profit, however small. And residents worked 10 to 16-hour days in factories. It's particularly cruel to tell people who are working 16-hour days, 6 days a week, that they live in poverty because they're lazy. John Snow was a 19th century physician who had qualms about the miasma theory of disease and believed that it was caused by a contagious poison that had to be ingested into the body through some kind of contamination. Critics mocked this morbid matter theory. Snow interviewed households in Soho and noticed that almost all of the cases of cholera were within a certain neighborhood that got water from the same source, a shallow well. He later demonstrated the effect that the well was having with a dot map, thus creating one of our first infographics. A key detail which confirmed Snow's suspicion was that the workers at the local brewery weren't getting cholera, presumably because they were drinking their beer ration instead of the water, and the water in the beer had been boiled as part of the brewing process. Authorities agreed to remove the handle of the well, and before long the epidemic passed. Snow claimed that this vindicated the idea that a pathogen had been passed from feces into the drinking water. The well had been infected by a poorly maintained cesspool in the area. Despite the success of Snow's recommendations, the health board investigated and determined that miasma had been the cause. Some doctors were so against the idea of this disease molecule that they went so far as to drink cultures of cholera bacteria. They generally experienced a range of cholera symptoms, usually mild. Presumably, this is because they had relatively little exposure compared to someone drinking this in their daily drinking water, and lived in conditions where their bodies would fight off the disease much better than urban workers could. Once a disease exhausts its possible hosts, it itself dies. A pathogen needs a sustainable life cycle. This might make you ask, then why would a pathogen kill at all? Wouldn't it be more sustainable if a disease was symptomless? The answer is that most killer microorganisms kill by accident. The Black Death, which is a bacteria, doesn't want to kill. It wants to spread. All pathogens are this way. In birds, influenza basically causes diarrhea as its method of spreading, and is much less deadly than in humans. In fleas, the plague bacteria causes vomiting. Bacteria multiply in a specific part of the flea's gut, which blocks it and causes the flea to starve. In an attempt to feed, the flea bites more and more victims, but, unable to properly swallow the new blood, the flea regurgitates blood into the bite wound, along with thousands of bacteria. I hope you weren't eating while listening to this. The process mostly takes place between fleas and rodents. Some rodents die of the infection, but most live, and it passes between the two. There are cases when the flea population outruns the rodent population, and the fleas have to go in search of other kinds of blood to fill their guts. This is the main way that the bacteria finds its way into humans, where it wreaks all kinds of new havoc and ultimately killed between a third and a half of all Europeans. The plague is like the flea. It's a kind of parasite. Parasites don't evolve to kill their hosts, or at least not many of their hosts. If a flea can only feed on rodents and the rodents die, then the flea dies. That's why the flea only sucks a small portion of the rodent's blood and then moves on. The flea spreads the plague because the bacteria has hijacked its impulses. It can no longer satiate its hunger, so it continues to bite and spread bacteria. This isn't what the flea wants to do. Similarly, the bacteria doesn't want to kill the flea or the rodent, at least not in significant numbers. But if all the rodents are to die, the flea has a backup plan. It can also drink the blood of other mammals. The bacteria shares this survival strategy. If it can't infect rodents, it will try to infect other animals. In many cases, it will be unsuccessful. It has evolved to interact with rodents in a certain way, and those strategies may not work in other animals. But when it finds its way inside of humans, its tools for infecting are devastating. It's easy to get the idea that single-celled organisms are less cunning in their survival strategies than animals of our size. But nothing could be further from the truth. No matter how simple or complex a life form is, how ancient or newly evolved, we all fight for the same resources. It's easy to get a bit chauvinistic about the complexity of other life forms. After all, we do have thumbs and we build cities. But you yourself are a city, built by single cells. Your body is a tremendous cooperative effort, pulled off by trillions of cells with specialized jobs, most interacting with the other cells only indirectly. In cooperation with the cells that contain your DNA, there's an equally complex network of single-celled organisms working to turn the multicellular organisms that you eat into chemical energy. To them, you are not a more complex form of life. You're an environment, a new ecological niche, where food is delivered directly to their homes. Some of these organisms evolved before the first fern poked its fronds above the water. Some of them, like the coronavirus, evolved last year. There are multicellular organisms that reproduce by spraying sex cells randomly into the ocean. There's parasitic fungi that can cause their ant host to climb a blade of grass to announce its presence to predator birds, where the fungus can incubate the next phase of its life cycle. Antiquity and complexity have no bearing on natural selection. To the pathogen, you are what the field is to the farmer. Whether you are exhausted of your usefulness and die, or if you survive to continue to host the pathogen, or if you evict it from your body completely, depends largely on how aggressively the pathogen exploits its environment, which is you. There are over 100 types of human papillomavirus, HPV, that circulate endlessly in the human population. We have vaccines against the 9 strains that cause cancer. A successful parasite is one that doesn't upset its host. Of the 1,500 or so pathogens that infect humans, 61% evolved to attack a different animal. Here are a few diseases and the animals that they attack. So African sleeping sickness, anthrax, trichinosis, and salmonella primarily attack livestock. Giardia, which is a parasite found in pretty much all the rivers of America, that I have had the absolute pleasure of hosting, attacks forest wildlife like deer. Leprosy attacks armadillos and rodents. Influenza predominantly circulates in birds and swine. Ebola, Zika virus, and the HIV predecessor SIV predominantly attack monkeys. And everyone's new favorite disease, SARS-CoV-2, predominantly attacks bats. Most of these diseases cause mild sickness in their intended host, and that helps them spread, using methods like vomiting and diarrhea. When they leap to humans, they become much more deadly. The late 18th and 19th centuries represent a perfect storm for disease. As technology changed economies in Europe and then in the rest of the world, economic centers shifted from rural resource gathering to urban resource processing. Advancements in agriculture allowed for a growing population boom that forced people from the countryside into cities to find work. This brought a huge influx of people into cities where, as mentioned before, they lived in cramped and unsanitary conditions. They also brought with them from their villages their own local strains of animal-borne disease. This created the perfect petri dish, pathogens converging from all over countries into their cities, and then shared between cities by travelers who could now move much further and faster than ever before. Diseases could never, quote, run their course. This was a fire that would never run out of fuel because the fuel, in the form of urban workers, kept arriving daily. So, what happened? How did we interrupt this? In the 19th century, the majority of deaths were attributed to diarrhea, fevers, and lung infections. Today, the top causes of death are heart disease, stroke, cancer, and non-communicable disease. Communicable disease has all but dropped off the map in terms of causes of death. Since the 1950s, the global death rate has dropped from 2% to 0.7% of the population each year, in large part due to public health campaigns. How do we explain such a huge shift? We see medicine and the practice of public health come of age in the 20th century, propelled by science, war, and pandemic. Most medicine up to this point was built on the work of the Roman physician Galen, who devised a system that explained how the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, affected the body in the form of four fluids, blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. Each of these humors had a connection to astrology and personality, and the balance within the body was supposed to control one's health as well as fortune. Recall that the medieval system saw health as one aspect of a person's life experience, which was dictated by forces like God and the movements of the stars. One's material realities represented only one aspect of this complex system of retrograde and prograde and hot and cold and choleric and phlegmatic. This worldview is deeply embedded in our language. The term for the disease cholera comes from the Greek chole, for bile, since it was meant to be caused by an excess of it. If I am habitually afflicted with black bile, then I am melancholy, from the Greek meles, meaning black, and chole, meaning bile. It's the Ravenclaw of humors. If I get too upset, I might vent my spleen, the organ that makes the black bile, which means I will argue and complain. The terms lugubrious, morose, and wistful all refer to this condition. This humor is associated with the celestial body and god called Saturn. So when Saturn appears to be moving backwards in the sky, a phenomenon caused by the rotation of the Earth and the orbit of Saturn, then Saturn is said to be in retrograde, and I might experience ill effects from my governing humor. Ideally, if I am too full of black bile, acting morose and mopey, then I should take laxatives to purge it. The most common version of this was the treatment for too much blood, which governed rage, and was controlled by the celestial body Mars, the god of war. Exsanguination, bloodletting, became the most popular method for balancing the humors, so much so that the top medical journal in the world today is named for the tool used for bloodletting, the Lancet. Slowly, evidence began to mount that tinkering with body fluids was not in fact balancing the body. As the 19th century progressed and more specific cures were found for specific diseases, a new theory began to take shape. Rather than grand explanations about the universe, as more data came to be collected and associated with illness, it became clear that most disease spreads under specific conditions. As the scientific method developed, some of these early methods came to be tested in laboratory conditions. At the same time, new ideas were developing about the nature of life. Scientists found it useful to look at all manner of samples with greater and greater magnification, and before long, it was discovered that living things are made up of cells. The cells could have massive variation in shape and size, but nevertheless, the world was teeming with organisms that could only be seen through the microscope. Soon after, it was found that most organs of the body were made up of similar-looking cells. These networks of similar cells are called tissues. Connections were then made between certain pathogens and the tissues that they affected. Looking at diseased tissue under a microscope opened up a new world of treatment, because doctors could see the organisms associated with the illness multiply or die in real time when exposed to various chemicals. A new orthodoxy began to slowly develop, which suggested that treatments could be made from potentially hazardous materials that are targeted at specific organisms that cause specific disease. Now we have the concept of pharmaceutical treatment. As early as the 16th century, Chinese doctors were conditioning the human immune system. Scabs formed from certain infectious diseases were ground into a powder and then dropped into scratches made on the patient's body. Sometimes this conferred an immunity or resistance to the disease that caused the scabs, and other times the patient would become ill or even virulent. In the 1760s in England, Edward Jenner was inspired to test a piece of folk wisdom. A forgotten aspect of the Enlightenment movement was that it often looked to folk remedies as starting points for empirical testing. He had heard that milkmaids never get smallpox, but they frequently had cowpox infections. Both of these conditions, as well as chickenpox, are named for the inflamed, painful, pus-filled pimples that they create, which are called pox. Cowpox and smallpox are caused by closely related viruses. Cowpox predominantly affects cows, as you might suspect, and was mainly seen in humans only on the hands of milkmaids who milked infected cows. Today, the disease lives on mainly in the UK and is transferred by cats, of all things. Jenner found that scraping a patient with a needle contaminated with the pus from a cowpox pustule made them immune to smallpox. So much so that he could and did inject them with smallpox scabs to test it. This was the only vaccine for about a century, and the term that we use, vaccine, is derived from the Latin for cow, because of the connection with cowpox. This smallpox vaccine was so refined that it became the test subject for the first global program to eradicate a disease. In 1979, the World Health Organization certified that the smallpox virus no longer exists in humans. The first vaccine had become the first eradication of a disease. In the late 19th century, we get a series of discoveries in quick succession. Ignaz Semmelweis, a Hungarian physician with a very tragic story, discovers that washing hands after performing autopsies can slash death rates caused by infection contracted within the hospital. In France, Louis Pasteur discovers that fermentation is not a chemical reaction. It's actually carried out by microorganisms, and that life will not spontaneously generate in a closed system. He pioneers his system of pasteurization, which essentially kills microorganisms by heating a liquid like milk or juice to just above the bacteria's die-off point for a certain amount of time. In Germany, Rudolf Virchow declares that all cells come from cells, which sets the stage for modern biology and evolutionary theory. Also in Germany, Robert Koch creates a system for connecting diseases to a specific pathogen, which more or less completes germ theory. The English doctor Joseph Lister demonstrated the practical applications of sanitization in surgery and slashed the incidence of postoperative infections. An American company years later would use his name for their brand of antiseptic mouthwash, Listerine. Suddenly, hundreds of diseases were tied to their causes, and new vaccines, serums, and treatment techniques rapidly transformed the way that we understand health. By 1918, American medicine was quickly catching up to European medicine, thanks to grants from the entrepreneurs Johns Hopkins of Baltimore and John D. Rockefeller of New York. The Johns Hopkins Hospital had earned a reputation as a model clinic for its evidence-based approach to treatment and clinical trials that carefully adhered to the scientific method. It had become an incubator for the greatest doctors of that generation. The Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research, helmed by Abraham Flexner, was the leading research institution, doing model laboratory research into vaccines and cures. This institute had recently been incorporated into the United States Army as Army Auxiliary Laboratory No. 1. The war had changed many things in America, most notably the economy. Across the board, patriotic fever was stirred up, while huge contracts came out of Washington. Wilson used every arm of the federal government to transform America into a fighting machine, and he'd been successful. Now boys were leaving small towns across the country to join up at cantonments across the country and eventually ship out to the Western Front. Now boys were leaving small towns across the country to join up at cantonments and eventually ship out to the Western Front. This should sound very reminiscent to the situation over the previous century caused by industrialization. Men, many of them farmers and ranch hands, were congregating at camps with insufficient space, food, and heating. The men huddled around stoves in thin blankets, waiting to be packed into trains and continue their progress towards Europe. Army doctors were already high on alert for an epidemic. Doctors had noted that epidemics took place after conflicts over the past few centuries, and now the mechanism was clear. Armies coming in contact with armies from other countries picked up new pathogens and brought them home to civilians when they demobilized. The only question was which disease it would be, and how much progress had been made against that disease. In fact, an epidemic had already struck the army, measles. So much working time was being lost to measles outbreaks that the army commanders had instituted some, not many, but some, regulations that the doctors demanded. Quarantining infected camps, better supply, and more sleeping space. Keep in mind, this doesn't even include the soldiers who were already in Europe. These were the problems at home. That's why when the first few reports of influenza appeared, administrators took little notice. Influenza was nearly as common as the cold, and although it could be deadly, it wasn't as severe as things like measles or pneumonia, and it was far more contagious. Starting perhaps as early as January, a weak flu strain began to circulate, and in the middle of summer, a wave of flu swept across the globe. Opinions differ on the starting point, but very likely it was the mass movement of troops that caused this disease to circulate. Some health professionals rejected that the disease could be flu at all, because it wasn't deadly enough. While most major countries were at war, most bad news was suppressed, either by the government or the newspapers themselves. Anything that could potentially hurt morale was seen as unpatriotic, and newspapers did not want to be unpatriotic. This is a time when men who couldn't be drafted for whatever reason volunteered to bully people in their workplaces into spending their money on war bonds, something that Catherine Ann Porter discusses in Pale Horse, Pale Rider. The crime of criticizing the war could and did land people in prison. One of the few uninvolved Western countries in this war was Spain, and the Spanish press continued to report on the flu freely throughout the war, including when King Alphonse VIII came down with it. This earned it the name Spanish flu, and I have been consciously avoiding using that name because it makes no sense. By August, the flu pandemic had died down. Even more incredibly, the Allies began to make progress on the Western Front. Across August and September, most assessments came to realize that victory for the Allies was only a matter of time. It appeared that the worst of the killing had already come and gone, and the world was still standing. Word spread that the flu was disrupting the German war effort, and blaming Germany for the flu became a patriotic decision. Then the flu returned, deadlier than ever. If we want to compare the coronavirus pandemic of this year to the influenza of 1918, we should start with the differences. Coronavirus and influenza are only distantly related. Their similarity comes from them both being RNA viruses, how they spread, and how they kill. All living things mutate from generation to generation, meaning that the genes of the children are not identical to the genes of the parents. DNA has a proofreading system built into its duplication. RNA does not. That means that RNA viruses can change quite dramatically from generation to generation, which makes them harder to vaccinate against and target. It also means that their method of attack is quite similar. These two viruses lock onto a receptor on one of your cells, essentially telling that cell that it can come in because it's part of the body, and then it hijacks the cell's reproduction system to produce copies of the virus's RNA. The cell eventually bursts open, and all the new baby viruses spill out into the system to infect other cells. A side effect of this is that two different RNA viruses can infect the same cell, and since they're just spraying their RNA into the cell, these different viruses can join up and recombine in new ways. This is part of how a virus can leap across species. If a human influenza and a swine influenza virus were to infect the same cell at the same time, the offspring can potentially infect either or both hosts. It's important to remember that the 1918 influenza was significantly more widespread and deadly than our... In Influenza infected somewhere around a third of all people, and it killed somewhere in the ballpark of 25 million people.
I think that's
fucking tear gas. It's important to remember that the 1918 influenza was significantly more widespread and deadly than our coronavirus pandemic. Influenza infected somewhere around a third of all people, and it killed somewhere in the ballpark of 25 million. Even if we see another major peak to this pandemic, it's unlikely that our death toll will approach 1 million. And the proportional number is even smaller because 5 billion humans have been born since then. 5 billion! The method by which the two viruses kill is also similar. Coronavirus causes SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, which exhibits as a fever along with typical cold symptoms and ultimately kills by compromising the lungs. Once lungs begin to fill with debris from the fight against the virus, secondary infections set in. Influenza kills in a similar way, through a condition called ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome. The strain in 1918 was so effective at turning the immune system against the lungs that doctors in autopsy would find lung tissue to be light and spongy to the touch. Physicians had only seen anything like it in poison gas attacks during the ongoing war. When the lungs can't clear themselves from coughing, pockets of infection can set into the lung tissue, called pneumonia. Doctors in 1918 had serum to fight pneumonia bacteria, but antibiotics hadn't been invented yet. Despite the huge flurry of research caused by the incredibly deadly pandemic, the cause wasn't discovered to be a virus until 1931, after it was identified in pig populations. The cause was assumed to be one of the many bacteria that opportunistically attack the lungs, and so methods attempted for conveying immunity against the influenza failed. They were treating for the wrong thing. The best that doctors could do was fight the pneumonia bacteria. In our fight against coronavirus, however, we already know our enemy. Another advantage that we have has to do with the virus's genes. Influenza viruses don't tend to be one species. We name them based off of the receptors that they have, which will determine how they dock with other cells. So, for example, the 1918 flu and the 2009 outbreak were caused by H1N1, meaning that it had the first type of H and the first type of N receptor. The most likely to cause a pandemic strain had been H1N3 up until 2009, because that was the flu that was circulating in pigs for most of the 20th century. Instead, a new influenza virus appeared of the H1N1 form that had the genes of human, avian, and swine flu lineages. Despite having the same shape, groups of flu virus don't have one specific genome that centers the group. Instead, they're called a mutant swarm, a group of organisms that act together and are similar, but are not similar enough to be a single species. Coronavirus, on the other hand, has very little genetic variation. This implies that it was discovered relatively quickly. It was probably only born sometime in the fall or winter of 2019, meaning that the first cases caught in January 2020 were likely some of the first cases at all. This should make the coronavirus easier to target with a vaccine. The symptoms we see from coronavirus are frankly less scary than the symptoms of the 1918 flu. Keep in mind that neither the strain, nor the receptors, nor the genes can easily account for differences in severity. It was presumably the same disease that attacked in the summer and in the fall, but the second wave was significantly more deadly. Pockets of death and survival around the world can only be partly attributed to environmental causes. The 2009 novel H1N1 caused nothing like the symptoms of the 1918 H1N1. The first thing that terrified people was the blood. Ships carrying infected soldiers across the Atlantic would arrive in France with blood literally sloshing around the decks. The 1918 flu had a particularly strong tendency to attack mucous membranes and degrade the tissues. So mucous membranes of the nose, throat, mouth, and even the vagina or anus could easily rupture and start to bleed. People experienced soaring temperatures accompanied by intense headaches, vomiting, and aching of the joints. Some spent weeks in agony from what was called breakbone fever because of the pain to the limbs. Lung damage in many patients caused cyanosis, which is when the extremities go blue from lack of oxygen. As the pandemic progressed, doctors and nurses considered patients with cyanosis to be walking dead and would even put toe tags on living patients who had gone blue. Some went into coma-like states as they battled through fever after fever. Catherine Ann Porter had such symptoms, which she describes like this, quote, "She sank easily through deeps and deeps of darkness until she lay like a stone at the farthest bottom of life, knowing herself to be blind, deaf, speechless, no longer aware of the members of her own body, entirely withdrawn from all human concerns." Some felt this brain fog for the next few years, and some felt it for the rest of their lives. Another terrifying aspect that we don't have to contend with was the loss of the particularly young and particularly strong members of society. When you graph mortality of a disease against age, you typically get a U shape. Disease typically kills people with weaker immune systems, so the very young and the very old tend to die the most. The 1918 flu had a strange W shape to its curve. A peak of deaths existed for the very young and for the very old, but another peak centered around the age 25. This has to do with the way that the virus caused death. The damage done to the lungs was typically done by the patient's own immune system, meaning that those with the strongest immune systems were also hard hit. For the 1918 pandemic, it was best to be an adolescent or be middle-aged. This made the virus have a greater cultural impact, as the most visible members of society were the hardest hit. Contrast this with the stats coming out from this pandemic, which show a pretty exponential graph by age. It looks like the right half of a U. Strangely, infants and toddlers show the lowest death rate, while the elderly have by far the highest. This has impacted our response to the virus, since the hardest affected, the very elderly, are already outside the labor pool, have little agency in their lives, and have little political power, their voices have been silenced. This group is also the most likely to follow radical right-wing news sources that have propagated conspiracy theories about the virus and discouraged taking action against it. So the group that is hardest hit has little ability to demand action, and even less incitement to. The main value in comparing our pandemic to theirs is because of the way that the two diseases spread. We've discussed how they're both RNA viruses. They share symptoms, and they kill in similar ways. The symptoms are also part of their method of spreading. Influenza and the coronavirus mostly cause diarrhea in their main host species, which is birds and bats, respectively. Poop dropping from flying animals is a pretty effective way to spread disease. In humans, the mucus buildup, coughing, sweating, vomiting, and diarrhea are all ways in which these pathogens can spread. The main way that they spread is through contact. That's why the most effective defense is washing hands and not touching your face, where the virus can enter your system. The secondary method these viruses use to spread is through the air, via small droplets of liquid. This usually means snot or spit from sneezing, coughing, talking, or even just breathing. I've been seeing some controversy, if you can call it that, about masks. Some cities, including my beloved Denver, required you to wear a mask to go inside of retail stores. The masks that most people are wearing are made of cotton. The masks widely used in 1918 were gauze. The weave of these masks is way too wide to prevent the tiny droplets from getting out or getting in. The main value of these masks is to prevent larger droplets that are produced by coughing or sneezing from going other places. This has to do with how much virus you're exposed to. People who are exposed to a greater amount of virus are more likely to get sick. In 1918, many cities illegalized spitting in public, and there was a minor outrage as people began to be arrested for spitting. But in fact, The less spit and snot and mucus that you come in contact with, the less likely you are to get sick. I haven't heard people talking about the main reason why I choose to wear a mask. When I have it on, I'm much less likely to rub my nose. I have constant allergies, and I'm always itching, and I'm a terrible face toucher to begin with. When I'm wearing a mask, it not only stops me from touching my nose directly, it reminds me not to rub my eyes either. In that way, the mask helps prevent the main method of transmission, which is touch. With these transmission methods in mind, let's talk about the social response to the virus. We responded much better to the coronavirus in 2019 than we did to the influenza in 1918. There's no question about that. The 1918 pandemic response just feels like a car crash in slow motion. So let's take a look at examples of pandemic response and their outcomes. The term influenza is another example of ancient conceptions of medicine in our modern language. It refers to the influence of the stars on human health. Humans have suffered influenza epidemics since as early as 1510. Since that time, influenza epidemics and pandemics have become increasingly common, probably because we have been traveling around the world faster and in greater numbers than ever. At least three flu pandemics hit Europe in the 18th century, and at least four in the 19th. A major pandemic hit in 1889, which offered some immunity to its survivors in 1918. Studies on immunity to the 1918 virus also revealed that another flu pandemic had created partial immunity, which could not be attributed to any of the known pandemics, meaning that even more flu pandemics happened in the 19th century than we noticed. The summer wave of flu in 1918 had been surprisingly deadly, peaked, and then receded. It was now autumn. John M. Barry, in his book The Great Influenza, describes outbreaks at army bases around the world in the fall of 1918 as being like bubbles that form when a pot of water is on the verge of boiling. As the temperature rises, first you see a few spots start bubbling from the bottom of the pot before the whole thing breaks into the boil. For the reasons discussed earlier, the army bases were uniquely vulnerable to fostering and spreading disease. Starting in August, they began to see more extreme symptoms I described in the last section. By September, even the best army hospitals were overwhelmed. At Camp Devens, near Boston, 1,500 soldiers reported ill on the same day. On September 22nd, 19.6% of the entire camp was on sick report. Hospitals were literally full to overflowing. The Devens Hospital, which could hold at most 2,500 patients, was now caring for 6,000. The nurses did all they could to fight against the flood of blood and mucus coming out of the patients, but their efforts couldn't keep the hospital sanitary. Camp Devens proved to be sadly typical of the situation within army bases, and it was only a matter of time before their pandemic spilled over into the general population. Philadelphia in 1918 was an overflowing industrial city. The immigration of industrialization had been accelerated by the war, and men were drawn from the surrounding areas to work in the new munitions and weapons factories. Often several families were living in the same two or three bedroom flats, and men would sleep in the same bed in shifts around their working shifts. This was the tinder for the fire. Then came the spark, which wasn't so much a spark as it was an already lit torch. As was typical in 1918, the mayor of Philadelphia did nothing to prepare for the influenza plague other than insist that it would not be a problem. There were already hundreds of sailors hospitalized in the city and over 1,000 dead in Boston. The medical board advised the population to stay warm, keep their feet dry, and keep their bowels open, drawing on ancient medical remedies. But the war raged on, and the American war effort ran on bonds. To raise the necessary bonds, parades had been organized to mobilize the people. The Philadelphia Liberty Loan Parade was scheduled for September 28th. By September 26th, there were now 1,400 sailors hospitalized with influenza. On the 27th, 123 civilians were admitted to the hospital. Pressure rose from all corners to cancel the parade. The latest round of draft had already been canceled for health reasons, and medical professionals the country over were demanding that all public gatherings be canceled. Instead, Philadelphia proceeded. On September 28th, 2 miles of paraders filed down the street, including Marines, sailors, and soldiers, and then spent the rest of the day shopping and socializing with the hundreds of thousands of civilians who came out to share their patriotism. Within 72 hours, every single bed in each of the city's 31 hospitals was filled. Soon, the city's daily death toll from influenza exceeded their weekly death rate from all other causes combined. City authorities and newspapers continued to insist that all was well, even as measures like the ban on public gatherings went into effect. The newspapers reported that the city had reached the peak of deaths on October 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, as the daily toll doubled from 200 to 400. Finally, on the 10th, the daily deaths peaked at 759 citizens dying in one day. All work had stopped in the city. People were too scared to go outside. This was the fire itself. Hospitals had long since been overrun with the sick, and now there was no way to get help. Think about that. You fall ill, and you literally can't go to the hospital because they don't have a bed for you. Even the doctors and nurses were falling ill and dying in droves. The ill had to rely on family or friends for nursing, if they had any who were well enough to do so. The lack of care doubtlessly killed thousands, and worse still, now people were dying in their own homes. The city became choked with bodies. Even daily carts taking the dead to mass burial sites couldn't keep up. The supply of coffins had long since run out, and the idea of a private burial for people's loved ones was unthinkable. Hospitals piled the dead up like cordwood, 10 bodies high. Inside of most houses in the city were one or more corpses slowly putrefying. These were the survivors' parents, children, teachers, preachers, doctors, employers, and employees. Meanwhile, the war marched on. Blaming Germany for the pandemic became common because it was considered patriotic. We saw an echo of that in President Trump's focus on blaming China for this disease. The White House acknowledged the violence that it was inciting against Asian Americans and stopped calling this pandemic China flu on March 23rd. The federal government and armed forces had spent most of the year turning the American economy into a machine for making war materiel and soldiers, and that process could not easily be reversed while the war continued. Men continued to shuffle to the East Coast in close, confined trains, and then board tightly packed ships. Although the latest round of draft had already been canceled because of the disease, the troop movements continued. Despite the military's half-hearted attempts to screen sick men, the troop transports became increasingly deadly. Within 48 hours of leaving port, the massively overcrowded troop ships filled with coughing and sneezing. Closed steel spaces with inadequate ventilation meant that there was nowhere to hide from the virus. And then the hemorrhaging began. Blood pooled on the floors and ran down corridors. In rough water, blood splashed on everything, clothes, faces, and now the bodies that lay in every compartment and every corridor. Eventually, the dead were given perfunctory funerals before being thrown into the sea. Ships arrived in Brest, France, with their sailors exhausted and decimated, already traumatized. Still, the movements continued. In the trenches, American soldiers died from influenza and fighting at the same rate, and yet still more sick men were being sent in. At the beginning of October, the Austrian government had sought peace on any terms. At the end of October, the Kaiser handed over power to a new Republican government. As discussed in the last podcast episode, this was part of a plot to frame the new Weimar Republic for the failure of this war. President Wilson made no public statement about influenza, nor did he direct any of the war economy to fighting it. He did summon the chief of staff of the army to discuss the issue of shipping men to France. General March replied that any sign of hesitation might cause the Germans to withdraw from the negotiating table, and that, quote, every soldier who has died just as surely played his part as his comrade who died in France, This actually makes sense given the World War One logic. They were attempting to deplete the other countries rather than conquer territory. For a month, the death ships continued making the Atlantic Passage until the war was formally ended on November 11th. In October, panic set in across the country. Schools, cities, and governments shut down. Meetings were held outside if necessary, and the gauze mask became virtually ubiquitous. The Red Cross warned that, quote, "the man or woman or child who will not wear a mask is now a dangerous slacker." Throughout the U.S., people living in isolated areas starved, as surrounding communities refused to transport food out of fear of catching the virus. Desperate doctors prescribed treatments they knew would not work, like vaccines and serums for other diseases, and long-debunked treatments. We're seeing an echo of this in President Trump's advice to take a provenly deadly combination of pharmaceuticals that haven't been shown to fight off the coronavirus. Blistering with mustard plaster, purging with mercury chloride, and even bleeding veins all made a comeback in 1918. New treatments were devised, such as attempting to turn the body alkaline, because the opportunistic bacteria have a hard time surviving in an alkaline environment. As a side note, don't attempt this. The body is very good at regulating pH. If you do manage to change your pH, it means something's very wrong. Soldiers were given antiseptic mouthwash and had disinfectant sprayed into their nose and throats. This, again, reminds us of our current crisis. The president suggested that the coronavirus should be fought with an injection of disinfectant to the infection site. This is not an effective treatment. Unfortunately, none of these methods cured the disease. Only nursing, pneumonia treatments, and quarantining had any effect. New York City was the hardest hit and continued to experience influenza deaths after the disease had died out in most parts of the world. Constant immigration allowed the disease to smolder like a fire constantly being fed fuel. Politics made this even worse. Starting in January of 1918, Tammany Hall made a concerted effort to reclaim the city government by replacing appointed positions with loyal men. In a few short months, they had replaced most of the health board, which had been a world-class institution, with men of no medical distinction, led by a homeopathic doctor who didn't have an MD. The Tammany machine would later elevate this doctor, Royal Copeland, to the Senate. A flood of criticism from health officials forced Copeland to resign, but New York went into the crisis with a demoralized and ineffective health leadership, which contributed to deaths. The U.S. and Europe weren't even the hardest hit by the virus. At the beginning, I mentioned that disease can be classist. This is true on a world scale, too. India, in particular Mumbai, was hit hard, as was China and Southeast Asia. Barry estimates that around 5% of the developed world died, while 10% of the developing world did. Quarantine, it seems, is the best guarantee of survival. People tended to fare better in the less populated West. Coloradans were particularly strict with their quarantines. Ouray, Colorado, had set up a shotgun quarantine, refusing access to all outsiders, and yet they were still hit by the flu. Silverton shut down before a single case was reported, and they suffered as well. Gunnison, however, a larger town and a major hub of rail traffic, was spared. They blocked off the roads to and from the town and informed train passengers that if they stepped off the train for any reason, including a cigarette, they would be spending a week in the town jail. Monument, another Colorado town, closed down all retail shopping. Groceries could be ordered by shouting through the windows and picked up at the door. Places that managed to delay the onset and flatten the curve of sickness experienced less death. San Francisco's ordinances had been so strict and effective that they saw only a fraction of the death that visited the similar city of Los Angeles. So much so that on November 21st, they announced the end of the ordinances. People took off their masks in a ceremony and went back to work and to the movies. It's hard to know how much the third and fourth waves of the influenza illness were caused by behavioral changes and how much was just the natural cycle of the virus. But it's clear that effective quarantines create fire breaks, which can stop the illness from circulating endlessly. Partly at the urging of the Anti-Mask League, the so-called onerous restrictions were dropped in San Francisco, and they saw another 2,000 of their citizens die before the end of the year. It was ultimately one of the hardest hit cities in the U.S. Denver is another city that acted fast, banning public gatherings and flattening the curve. By armistice, though, on November 11th, business leaders had decided that they had overreacted. Restrictions were lifted, and by November 22nd, deaths were higher than ever. Even as city officials tried to reinstate restrictions, city business owners protested at the Capitol, fearing that they would lose even more money. Ultimately, citizens were unwilling to endure another period of quarantine, and deaths in Colorado, despite all of the measures I've mentioned, had a higher rate than the national average. I live not far from the Capitol building, and I got to witness a very similar protest a few weeks ago. I saw signs saying things like, "I need a haircut and I want to go shopping," as the death toll from coronavirus rose day by day. If we are able to take anything from our last experience with pandemic, it should be that opening up restaurants and bars right now would be the best way to ensure that deaths continue for the rest of the year. As Dr. Fauci has said, if it looks like you're overreacting, you're probably doing the right thing. At this point, reopening too quickly risks undoing all of the good that the quarantine has done so far. The H1N1 influenza continued to kill throughout 1919 and into 1920, at lower rates as it circled the globe again and again. It seems that the virus reached its peak of lethality in the fall or winter, and then went back to being less lethal. This can happen when a virus passes through several hosts. So, for example, when Ebola is passed from human to human, it's much less lethal than when it initially passes into the human population. The coronavirus, when passed from bats to humans, can be imperceptible. Current theories suggest that it gained lethality by passing through a pangolin population and then transferring to man. Perhaps the last casualty of the influenza was peace. Throughout 1919, President Wilson attended the peace conference in Paris. In fact, despite the United States' late entry, he found himself at the center of the conferences. The French and British delegations seemed intently focused on punishing Germany. Wilson felt strongly that there would be, quote, no peace in victory, and that the treaty's first priority should be ensuring peace rather than victory. He came down with influenza. Some reports and even histories claim that this was a stroke. Wilson had had strokes before and after this time, but he was confined to his bed with flu for several weeks. Future President Herbert Hoover was also working with Wilson in Paris at the time, and he wrote, quote, "Prior to that time, in all matters with which I had to deal, he was incisive, quick to grasp essentials, unhesitating in conclusions, and most willing to take advice from the men he trusted. Now, others as well as I have found that we've had to push against an unwilling mind." His aides commented that Wilson was never the same after his influenza. Suddenly, Wilson stopped fighting, and he conceded to Clemenceau that the Rhineland be demilitarized, that the rich Saar coal fields would be given to France, and that Germany would bear full responsibility for the war and pay for all of the country's debts. All of these would be major talking points for Hitler's revanchism. Germany's colonies in Africa were given to Italy, and those in Asia were given to Japan, which sets the stage for the Axis alliance in World War II. Wilson left Paris not long after, saying, quote, "If I were German, I would not sign it." He was never able to get the centerpiece of his plan, an international community called the League of Nations, passed by Congress, and the body found itself toothless without American support. I'm happy to report that there were positive results from the 1918 flu as well, mostly in medical science. Most research was directed at a bacteria called B. influenzae, still considered the prime suspect as the pathogen that caused influenza. For a decade, better and better techniques for isolating bacteria and creating agar conducive to their growth were discovered. One of the scientists experimenting with B. influenzae, Alexander Fleming, in September of 1928, almost exactly a decade after the pandemic, discovered that a sample of Staphylococcus wasn't properly covered, and a fungus from the open air had killed it. Fleming cultured the fungus and discovered that it was penicillin, and suggested that it could be used as a clinical solution for bacterial infections. In the 1930s, intravenous solutions were devised, and in the 40s, we had a new tool in our war on disease, antibiotics. Ironically, the bacteria he'd been experimenting with was Staphylococcus, and it's quickly becoming the most common antibiotic-resistant infection. This is partly the result of overprescription of antibiotics in humans, partly due to patients not finishing the full course of their antibiotics. Leaving any bacteria alive ensures that the survivors are the most antibiotic resistant. But it's mostly because livestock are dosed with huge level of antibiotics to prevent infection in the close, unsanitary conditions in which they're kept. 70% of antibiotics used in America go to livestock. An obvious starting point to fixing this issue would be to keep chickens, pigs, and cows in more sanitary conditions with less crowding. Another major discovery that came out of the 1918 pandemic has to do with genetics. Through the first half of the 20th century, science had accepted that the process of natural selection described by Darwin and the system of genetic inheritance described by Mendel could explain evolution. But the actual substance that transmitted genes was not yet known. Oswald Avery was a researcher who strongly believed in the bacterial origin for influenza and doggedly worked towards understanding it for decades after his colleagues had moved on. When the influenza virus was discovered in 1936, his research veered towards the immune system in general. It was known that the worst of the damage of influenza came from the immune system itself attacking the cells of the body. Avery discovered that this reaction was triggered by bacteria in the cell casings, but not the cell casings or the bacteria themselves, only when the two were combined. Through a painstaking process of elimination, he discovered that bacteria without cell casings could gain cell casings when introduced to a certain carbohydrate. This went against the intuition of the time. Genes are complex things, and they need many variables to pass on the complex information that they hold. Therefore, the medium for genes was assumed to be protein, which is much more complex than an acid. In 1944, Avery published a landmark paper proving the genetic information was passed via a polymer called deoxyribonucleic acid. A decade later, Watson Crick and Rosalind Franklin discovered the structure of DNA and described how just two sets of two chemical pairings could encode an entire genome, opening the door to modern genetics research. From my investigation into the history of pandemics, I've come away with this. Of all the measures a person can take, in this case, the most effective is the oldest. Social distancing, for all the trouble it causes, works, and a quarantine works even better. We are lucky in that we have a choice. In Boston, Philadelphia, New York, and several other major American cities in 1918, the economy shut down not due to public officials, but due to death and fear. The paucity of fire breaks and containment allowed the virus to kill for years after 1918. Additionally, it's not just the deaths we need to worry about. People who get so sick that they almost die are often changed and weakened by the experience for the rest of their life. As I said at the beginning, the Denver newspaper woman Catherine Ann Porter was haunted by her experience with death for the rest of her life. Quarantining efforts only have an effect as long as they are continued for the entirety of the outbreak, or else you just have delayed the onset of the sickness, just like San Francisco and Denver. The height of pandemic, the point that we're at right now, is not the time to stop fighting. Let's honor our work so far, and honor the elderly members of our society by making sure we kick this virus's butt. If not, we risk it recombining with other coronavirus strains currently circulating, which could cause a second, more deadly wave, as in the case of influenza. The final note I want to leave on is information and misinformation. Spanish flu got its name from the only country that was willing to talk about the flu. Throughout the U.S., public officials and newspapers insisted that the only thing to fear was fear, that being afraid would cause more deaths than the flu. As they continued assurances that everything was getting better, in the midst of the peak of the death, they lost credibility, and a deeper panic spread. One that left isolated communities without supply, and left patients alone in their homes with no one to nurse them. Catherine Ann Porter was one of the lucky ones. She was treated in a hospital and survived. There were thousands who could not find help and died. Furthermore, in both the 2003 SARS and the 2009 H1N1 outbreak, early and correct information helped put the right measures in place and stop these diseases from having the kind of effect that we're seeing with the coronavirus pandemic. I see an echo of 1918 in the communication that we're seeing from world leaders during this crisis, especially in America and the UK, urging people not to take precautions. When you take precautions, you are not living in fear. You're living in fear when thousands of your countrymen are dying every day, and your leaders continue to lie and say that everything is all right. Things are not all right. When 100,000 of your countrymen die over the course of a few months, that's not all right. As the New York Times said, it's an incalculable loss. But it's nowhere near as bad as 1918. We have all the tools and knowledge we need to bounce back from this. We don't need to wait for a vaccine, but we do need to wait for the worst to pass and then ease off of quarantining slowly. We live in an age when many of us can work from home, shop online, and stay in close contact with our friends and family virtually. Our burden is a tiny fraction of what the people who have lived through pandemics before experienced. We can defeat this pandemic and know that our actions saved the lives of our most vulnerable countrymen. And in that sense, it's our patriotic duty, not just to the country, to your species. I'm Peter McGuire, and this has been my unlikely explanation. And it is quickly becoming the most antibiotic. We had a new tool in our war on disease. Antibiotics.